Dream job or nightmare? It's hard to know if a career that looks great on paper will actually lead you to the life you want to live. So welcome to Dream Job Cafe. I'm Larry Port. I'll be asking different professionals the questions you won't find anywhere else. So grab a coffee, settle in. This is Dream Job Cafe.
Sponsored by Wayspark.co, where we help people navigate careers in a crazy world.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Dream Job Cafe podcast. I have with me today Ben Berkman. He is a data scientist with the Trade Desk. And Ben, welcome. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Larry. Looking forward to it.
So, Ben, tell me a little bit about like what a data scientist at the Trade Desk does.
Certainly. So at a high level, maybe just a high level of what the Trade Desk does first. So despite its name, it's actually not a finance company. It's an advertising technology company.
Interesting.
So maybe the 10,000 foot view is that the goal of the Trade Desk is to help major brands or major companies, which are our customers, spend their advertising budgets as effectively as possible and to build out the technology that supports that, right? So let's take an example, right? When you load your web page or fire up your smart TV, there's actually an auction that takes place in that 10th of a second. So again, you're navigating to the New York Times, for example. When you load that website, they essentially send out a message that we have an ad slot available, and here's what we know about that viewer. And then companies like the Trade Desk and other companies effectively evaluate that ad opportunity and determine, is that opportunity valuable for one of our advertisers, and should we bid on that potential impression? So ultimately, right, if we place the highest bid, that opportunity, that advertisement is served, and the user, the loader of that web page, really never notices this entire process. Again, that happens in about a 10th of a second. So specifically, my role within the Trade Desk is I work on building out something called our cross-device graph or our identity graph. It's essentially a product that maps every device, so that could be every phone, computer, tablet, to a person and to a household. So this enables several key things in the world of advertising. One is something called cross-device reach, being able to advertise to individuals across their devices. One is frequency management, so the ability to not target an individual more than 30 times within a week, for example, and also the ability to measure the effectiveness of an advertising campaign at a person and a household level.
Wow. So this is sophisticated stuff. All right. So for those that don't know or are new to this, like most online advertising is driven in a very analytical way where there's maybe some information known about a user and then there's ads sewn up. So this is like kind of goes a step beyond. It's a more of an auction process. And so while this must be phenomenal, so the proceeds then like go to the New York Times and you guys take a fee. Is that how it works? Or how do you guys get paid? Just out of curiosity.
Exactly. So we have a fee, right? So effectively, an advertiser provides us, say, $1 million to spend, right? And to spend responsibly, they trust that using our AI and our machine learning will place that advertisement to the right individual, maybe better than they could do themselves. So as a result of that service, we take a fee off of the amount of their advertising that we spend. And that's how largely our company makes money.
Wow. Interesting stuff. So I could see how when you think about the decline of the magazines, that it's not just the readership decline, but also like on the advertising side, the amount of information, like the way that you're describing it right now, to be able to get in front of somebody and have them view an ad based on this preference or that preference, that is just so much more targeted and measurable than it is to get a full page ad in a magazine like Vogue or something like that. I could see how this could hasten the demise of traditional print media. Let's get into a little bit about it. So are you doing programming or are you digging into the numbers or are you using programming to dig into the numbers or how does it exactly work? Like you come into the office and what's it like?
Yeah, absolutely. So I would say I spend about 6 hours of my day, maybe programming, coding. That could range anywhere from, you know, working on a new product or a new feature. So developing a new algorithm, a new approach to how we do things, experimenting with a new approach, to also, you know, analyzing kind of how our current product is behaving, crunching data, historical data, ensuring that, you know, our product is kind of performing as we expect. So about 6 hours of the day is really kind of working by myself. I do go into an office, but working largely by myself, collaborating with teammates to an extent, but primarily kind of coding and doing that nature of work. Maybe 2 hours of the day are spent in meetings, you know, syncing with teammates about our projects, how we can help each other out, or providing like a stand-up update to a product manager, for example. But it is, you know, teamwork, though largely most of the actual time is spent kind of by myself in a coding environment, which I personally enjoy.
Yes, I used to love that. I used to do something very similar. Do you listen to music while you code, just out of curiosity?
I do, yeah. I can't listen to podcasts. I've tried, or audiobooks, but I wish I could, because that would make, you know, me a bit more efficient in two pursuits. But yes, primarily non-distracting music.
Yeah, I would listen to like more, the spacier the better. I started like Pink Floyd would work for me. For some reason, I could use classic rock. But then I started getting into like Brian Eno and ambient type stuff. I mean, what do you kind of listen to? Do you have any like programming, like music suggestions?
I don't, honestly. I really just tune into my Spotify Discover Weekly, which at this point, I feel like my Spotify algorithm doesn't really know who I am. So it's all types of music.
It's not ear anything?
I haven't been served any Swift recommendations, but this week it's been a lot of Bad Bunny because of the Super Bowl.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm not too picky.
So
just not silence.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this then. Is it in Python? Because I know a lot of data science stuff is done in Python, or is it something else?
So currently I'm not using too much Python. I certainly have in previous roles. Right now I'm using a language called Scala, and we do a lot of work in Spark, which is kind of like a framework, a big data framework that Scala supports well.
Wow. Okay. So, and how is, you know, I mean, because there's the role of a software engineer, which is like using software to build features for a product, and then this data science. It sounds like there's some overlap here. How are they different?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I work very closely with engineers. So my team is about 3 data scientists and maybe 5 engineers. So it's actually a very engineering heavy project, due in part just to the size of our data. Our platform essentially evaluates 14 million of these ad opportunities a second.
I might not have
that number exactly correct, but it is something, you know, extremely high like that. So kind of the engineering focus is very important. But all that to say, you know, I work very closely with engineers. Maybe the key difference that I would describe is the engineers kind of, I would say, support me. They build out, you know, data pipelines for me, meaning they kind of manage the flow of the data from, you know, one system to another, while I kind of use that data and use the flows and the pipelines they create to build algorithms or build models that ultimately kind of inform our product. So it's a very complementary process. I have a very good working relationship with the engineer I work most closely with. But again, I would describe their function as kind of considering the big data applications, how we can, you know, serve the model or the algorithm that I'm building. And my work is almost a bit more, I would hesitate to say maybe, but potentially creative, in the sense that kind of, you know, I'm determining ultimately what we do with that data that they're helping move around.
Okay. So in some ways, it was kind of like how I had this job when I was working in Wall Street, and maybe see if this is an analogy. So I worked on the front end of a trading system to trade stocks. But in order to have a system like that, there were like a lot of like major components that other engineers were doing that were like kind of heavier lifting type stuff that fed market data, fed the stock prices, and did all this kind of stuff. So are you doing the stuff that more is of the business requirements that the end user is using, and then the engineers maybe are building the like scaffolding and the infrastructure required to support what you're doing?
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. We call it the plumbing, but scaffolding works well as well. Absolutely. Like, I certainly liaise and interact more with, you know, our product manager and with other teams, communicating kind of the outputs potentially of our product and the data products that, that our team creates. Again, the engineers, exactly to your point, kind of, you know, build out the support infrastructure that's incredibly necessary to be able to do that.
And with your work in data science, is it more than like the other feature that you commonly see with software engineering is that the UX designer or the product manager says, this is what it should do. But in your case, is it also like, well, we could also do this kind of manipulation with the data and maybe this would be a value? Like, does it go more both ways in your job?
It's interesting. At the Trade Desk, I've worked kind of on two primary projects. One was very driven by engineering and by data science, meaning we came up with the requirements with how we thought the product should work. And the PM largely took, you know, a role in just communicating that to other teams. In a separate project, it was quite different in that the project was very much driven by the product management team. And, you know, the engineering was essentially executing those requirements. I think there are benefits to both, right? Maybe the product manager understands the business case a little bit more, but the engineering-driven projects understand what we're able to do reasonably, maybe a little bit more. But I've definitely seen both cases. I don't think there's necessarily one that dominates. I think throughout data science, either setup is quite popular.
So talk to me a little bit about, how did you get here? Like, let's go with that. Like, what were you strong at in like high school or college, and how did all this like play out for you?
Yeah, absolutely. So both my parents are academics, but neither of them are very quantitative individuals. my dad may beg to differ a bit, but you know, they're both professors in the liberal arts, and I grew up primarily interested in you know, liberal arts education. In high school, I was, you know, relatively well-rounded, but and strong at math and the sciences, but I wouldn't say it was my passion or what I most excelled at. My kind of outside of work interests were more in writing, actually, and in languages. I was very into journalism in both high school and college, and
interesting,
and studied French throughout high school and college as well. In college, yeah, I also pursued more of a liberal arts education. I studied economics with, you know, a quantitative focus, but it certainly wasn't, you know, computer engineering or anything. So my path to data scientist was, you know, slow, but also pretty linear. So my first job out of college, I was working in Washington, D.C. as like an analytics consultant, essentially, for the government, working for a small company, but actually sitting in the basement of the Pentagon. It was a very strange first job out of college. But in that role, I started using R and programming for the first time, and really just like fell in love with programming and coding, kind of in the same way that I love to learn other languages, for example. And I realized like that this was definitely what I wanted to do with my career. Then COVID hit, and I actually began a graduate program for data science, a master's of data science at NYU. And that really provided like the full-fledged training of what it means and what it's like to become a data scientist. And through those resources and moving to New York, started my first job at a smaller startup as a data scientist. There I was working primarily in Python. That's when I learned a bit about identity graphs and social network graphs and graph data structures, which is what I became interested in. And that's essentially a very similar role to what I do now at the Trade Desk, just in a different industry. And that's kind of how I wound up here.
Fascinating. So listen, the one thing, full disclosure, that I know Ben outside of the podcast world. So Ben's dad, who we just discussed, the academic is married to my sister, which makes us some sort of relative, maybe.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly what you would call that. But
no, I don't know. So yeah.
Step uncle?
Step something. I don't know that I'm, no, maybe. Yeah. Okay. But what's interesting is, I don't know if you know this, but when I was an undergraduate, I studied Spanish and radio, TV, film at Northwestern. So I studied abroad in Spain, and I was the editor of my school newspaper, and I did a lot of like photography. So I didn't, I ended up like programming through this program at NYU, and I fell in love with it. I like the kind of puzzle Sudoku nature of it. It is appealing. So, and I'm wondering if, like, you know, econ is such a good blending of social science and like kind of analytics. Do you feel that that gives you like your background that's not pure hardcore science, and that the fact that you had some like some of the more social science and liberal arts tradition, do you feel that that's a benefit like in how you work, in especially in this kind of an environment? I know I felt that it was an advantage that not just having the hardcore CS background. Can you talk a little bit about that?
It's a good question. I certainly agree. Yeah. I mean, I think one thing that, you know, a liberal arts education should help you learn is, you know, how to communicate, especially, you know, especially via writing. And that's like, that is an underrated but very important aspect of my job, for one. So just being able to communicate thoughts and, you know, work with individuals from a lot of different backgrounds and skill sets. I think the second thing is, you know, a liberal arts education also fosters, you know, a sense of curiosity. And that's really, I think, probably the key skill, in my opinion, to being a good data scientist, is just an ability to be curious, to interrogate data, to, you know, understand a very ambiguous problem. I think these are skills that are, you know, amenable to someone with a liberal arts background. And I also think, to your point, like learning a language, especially, you know, later in life, potentially when it's not a very natural process, aligns pretty closely with learning, you know, how to program. And some of those skills are also quite transferable. So it may not seem like the most natural fit, but exactly, you know, I've had a similar experience to yours, is that, you know, that background does align pretty well with being a data scientist.
Yeah, I felt that like it gave me an advantage over people, especially with a way to communicate clearly, like you said, and maybe approach problems differently. Talk to me a little bit about AI and how you use it in your job, what platforms you're using, and is it something that you rely on a day-to-day basis, or just talk a little bit through that.
Absolutely, yeah. So even in the past, I think 2 months, maybe since the beginning of this year, we've had like another almost step function increase in the skills and the ability of AI. Just a quick, you know, side story, right? Like there's this engineer who is the founder of OpenAI. His name's Andrei Karpathy. He tweeted about a week ago, he's one of the more prominent engineers, you know, in the world, that just in the past 2 months, his kind of workflow went from 80% manual coding to 20% AI agentic coding to 80% AI driven coding and 20% manual coding. And he called this like the biggest shift in his workflow in over two decades in his career.
Was he using OpenAI or was he using Claude Code?
Well, he no longer works at OpenAI, I'm not sure what he's using now. Probably Claude, honestly. But, you know, I think my experiences have kind of mirrored that as well. Like really just in the past 2 months, with the release of the newest, you know, Opus and Codex models, there's been like huge increases in ability and also adoption, both from an individual, but also from an enterprise, my company standpoint, in really investing in using AI. So I guess to answer your question, you know, a big portion of my day now is understanding the best way to leverage these AI tools, the best ways to avoid the pitfalls of some of them, but really just, you know, trying to stay on pace with this truly almost exponential kind of acceleration of these tools. I find it really interesting. I'm personally into it. So that's kind of helped me at work because I enjoy kind of learning the shiny newest thing. But for some colleagues who, you know, are less, you know, less bullish on AI potentially, you know, there's kind of almost this like fracture forming, if you will.
When I look at like Bureau of Labor Statistics or Brookings or these people that are like looking at labor markets from this big kind of macro level, they're divided into two camps. So one camp is the augmentation camp, which is AI is going to augment what people are currently doing. And then there's the replacement camp, whereas AI is going to replace what a lot of people are doing. Where do you fall into that?
So to hedge just a little bit, I think we're really on the like the precipice of finding out. And again, it all kind of comes back to just the big advancements in the past 2 months. So we've seen, you know, evidence already to an extent that these newer tools might have the potential to replace some jobs, right? Like Anthropic's product Claude released this product Claude Cowork that automates a bunch of, you know, jobs or even tasks that involve, you know, moving data around or building out PowerPoints. A personal anecdote, I have a friend who works in an investment bank who said he's been giving to Claude Cowork the same tasks that he's been giving to his junior analysts and essentially comparing the outputs. And in many cases, Claude is outperforming those junior analysts. So I think certainly for some junior tasks, like there is evidence already that a number of jobs might be automated away. But maybe to focus more on my profession, data science, you know, I think certainly the nature of the job will change pretty drastically. I'm not sure if I can't definitively say if a number of jobs will be removed, but certainly I think much more of our job will become working with AI, interacting with AI. And actually, I think it relates back to our conversation about having a liberal arts background. This could really benefit us because a lot of the job, in my opinion, will turn into working with AI to really craft out design documents, you know, written documents that indicate what we want to build, how we want to build it, and then letting AI do the more mechanical portions. And again, I think that is kind of geared towards individuals with our background, not exclusively, but I think in general, we'll have to really adapt how we do work to stay successful.
Interesting. Yeah. I think that, like, you know, for, I don't want to scare off people that are in computer science or these data science courses or minors or majors. I think it's important to understand the underpinnings of how all this kind of stuff works. But I'm with you. Like, I see it almost like a, like if I was in college, I see it almost like a better minor than a major, like a better, like a complement towards something that is going to really tax the way you think in a different way. Like, even if it's like philosophy or political science or English or something like that, that is, you know, really tackling human reasoning and issues of that nature, I think. Because that, I don't know how you feel about this, but from my perspective, like everybody that I talk to on this podcast, they say the same thing, that like what we need are people that can handle the volatility and the uncertainty and be able to adapt and just like kind of react to things, which is not necessarily, I don't know if that's true in your job, but like people are really looking for people that can handle all this ambiguity very well. Is that
absolutely,
is that your case as well, would you say?
I think so. I may not be entirely understanding what you're asking. Sorry. The ambiguity around the changing nature of
work? Your work of okay. like things change rapidly. It may not necessarily be clear what the problems are. It might not necessarily be clear what the solutions are. You know, more kind of adaptive thinkers than rote task performers may have more and more currency going forward. I don't know. Could be.
I'm not sure if I have much to say on that, but yeah.
Well, let me ask you this. Like, there, you know, there's still a lot of organizations that are like, there's so much data. There's so many people trying to understand the data. I would think that there is at least currently demand for this profession. Like, who would you think should go like, who would be a good candidate to go into this line of work as a data scientist?
Yeah.
And who should, like, avoid it like the plague?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think there may be a few characteristics of data scientists, not to make sweeping generalizations, but I'll do my best. I think one, and I mentioned this already, is just individuals who are curious, right? Like, enjoy ambiguous problems, enjoy solving problems with a team, and, you know, enjoy kind of interrogating and assuming data is wrong until proved otherwise. So problem solvers and curious individuals, I think, do well as data scientists. Maybe more personality wise, you know, the bulk majority of our job is sitting at a desk coding or on our keyboard. It's a relatively steady profession in that sense, I would say, meaning the days are not super volatile. And that can be either good or bad, depending on how you look at it, right? You know, most days, to some extent, model other days. There are no really bad days, and often there aren't many extremely good days. So in some sense, you know, it's not incredibly dynamic, meaning there aren't, you know, you're not traveling the world or having large client meetings or going out to many dinners. So if you, you know, prefer a career maybe that's more geared towards that lifestyle, for example, being a data scientist might not necessarily be the job for you. But again, if you kind of prefer that steadiness, a bit more of that kind of the, you know, what your day, your week, your month might look like, and enjoy kind of solving these ambiguous, challenging problems, I think those people are who often become and enjoy being data scientists.
Okay, that's great advice. Now, let's talk a little bit about, like, what kind of, it sounds like nice and steady work. Is it the kind of work where you can put turn your phone off at night and, like, have a family dinner, like, on a scale of 1 to 10? Would it pass the family dinner test, would you say?
So, you know, your mileage may vary. I would say for myself, I'll rate it an 8 for the reason primarily that the Trade Desk is a global company. My product manager is actually based in Singapore. So there are two overlaps with US time and Singapore time, really, and that's very early in the morning or at dinner. So most days I have some back and forth right around dinner time with this individual. And but it's, you know, just, you know, typing over Slack primarily. About once a week we have a meeting that kind of falls over dinner. But other than that, you know, it would have to be a very bad day that I would not be able to, you know, have dinner with my wife or go to a workout class or, you know, relax in the evening after work. So that's kind of why I give it not quite a 10, but overall it's pretty good.
That's pretty solid. Yeah. Let's see. So what about this one? Like, what if you wanted to go deeper? Would you be able to commit to coaching a little league team, which is, like, you know, multi-hour commitment, like maybe 2-3 times a week? Scale of 1 to 10, would that be possible?
I think it certainly would be. I would probably also give it an 8.
All right.
I don't have children, but my manager, you know, he has 3 daughters and is kind of, I don't think he's the little league coach, but is constantly, you know, shepherding them to sporting events.
Travel that.
So, and, you know, we're able to communicate asynchronously, kind of because we're a global company, we're used to different time zones. So I certainly think that would be possible.
Okay. And then also, I don't want to get into specific salary ranges. That's something that people can look up on salary.com or whatever. But in general, let's say like 10 years out when you're raising a family, is this the kind of thing? This is the Disney World test, okay? There's the cheap version of Disney World where you bring peanut butter sandwiches, and that's for a family of 4 for a week. According to our AI friends, that's approximately $5,500. The middle version is $8,500. The deluxe version where you stay at the Contemporary and all that kind of stuff is $12,000 for a family of 4 for a week. Is this the kind of thing where you'd be able to do the deluxe version, middle version, low version? Like, any idea there?
You know, my parents never brought me to Disney World when I was growing up, and now maybe I see why that is shockingly shockingly expensive. So yeah, once I get past that sticker shock, however, I think, you know, why not give my children and my family a fun experience? I think we would be able to make the deluxe version happen.
You could probably have that happen. Oh, that's great.
Yeah. I will say with the compensation, right? Like, you know, if you work at a public company like myself, and as you get more senior, a lot of your compensation is tied up in how the company performs through stock. So, you know, there can be some variability year to year or even quarter to quarter when your stock vests in terms of how much, you know, income you have. Anyone could look up the Trade Desk stock recently and see that it's been a challenging year, but, you know, that does ultimately play a bit of an unknown factor in your earnings.
Gotcha. All right. Well, look, I think this has been a great conversation about like what it's like to work as a data scientist. I don't know if you have any closing remarks or anything you want to share else that we didn't cover.
I think that's it. Yeah. Thank you, Larry. This was a lot of fun.
All right, Ben, thank you so much. If you like this podcast or if you think it would be beneficial for someone, please share it or like it in your favorite podcast app. And if you can, please be grateful for something today.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget to like and subscribe to Dream Job Cafe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen. And don't forget to check out wayspark.co, where we help people navigate careers in a crazy world.